And to get a sense of the atmosphere of this passage, I want you to think about a time when you had a really enjoyable vacation. For most of us, that seems like a distant memory as we're heading to the end of the year. But maybe this year or some other year, as you look back, there was just a great highlight in getting away and enjoying something special on vacation. Maybe you were relaxing in the cool mountains or at the sunny beach or hiking at a rugged national park out west. Maybe you chose to explore the sights and the culture of another country altogether, or just staying close to home and shopping at secondhand stores and having extended conversations at hip coffee shops. Maybe you enjoy riding roller coasters at an amusement park, or maybe just going back to your hometown and hanging out with people that you grew up with that you haven't seen for a while. And whatever it was a wonderful experience. And you got out of it what you wanted. It was fun and restful and refreshing. But all too soon, it was over. And it was time to go back home. And you dreaded it. You knew that when you got back home, school was going to start back up in some cases, with its daily grind of classes and assignments and tests. Or maybe you'd be facing, again, a never-ending pile of laundry to wash and floors to sweep. Or for others, long hours of tedious work at the office. There would be more bills to pay, more lawns to mow, maybe more difficult relationships to navigate, more disagreements to resolve. Life is tough. Vacation is over, and it's time to get back to reality. Well, that is precisely what is happening as we come to Exodus chapter 16. After all of the upheaval of the Exodus and the Red Sea and the initial trials that the Israelites faced in the wilderness, you might remember at the end of chapter 15, the Lord gave them a little bit of a respite. It was a kind of a vacation. And he led them to a place. And it tells us that at that place there were 12 springs of water and 70 plants. They encamped there by the water. It was vacation time for them. And no doubt in the plan of God, it was a refreshing time, a time of rest, a time of recovery, a time to celebrate all that they had seen of the Lord's working for them, a time to catch up with family and with friends. But for as great a time as that was, you cross the line into chapter 16, and now it's time to get moving again. And it's time to get moving specifically back to the wilderness. Look at verse 1 of chapter 16. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. What is going to happen as these people head back to the desert? And what is it that you and I are supposed to learn from it so many thousands of years later? You know, sometimes it's a struggle reading the Old Testament to come up with an application. But in a case like this, it's really not hard at all, because we have some very to-the-point guidance from the New Testament. I want to read to you a little bit from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And in that passage, the Apostle Paul is tracking through some of the events that the people of God faced in the desert, issues that are recorded in the book of Numbers that they're very parallel to what we're talking about here. And he says this in verse 6, "Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire as they did, desire evil as they did." And he goes through a list of various sins that their mistakes urge us to avoid by negative example. And among those is in verse 10 that we should not grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. And right after he warns us against the grumbling like they did, verse 11 says, now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, here's the application. Let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. In other words, even under the blessed situation of the new covenant, the same thing could happen to us. Take heed lest you fall into the same traps as the people of Israel did. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. So don't just be warned, be also encouraged that God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. And so we are taught that our lives are going to face parallel circumstances to the desert sort of experiences, and we're going to face similar temptations and struggles that go along with it. These wilderness stories, they are rich with spiritual lessons about human nature, about temptations to sin, about how to resist those temptations, and about how God is faithful. Now, we saw an overview of some of those lessons as we were finishing up Exodus chapter 15, before the Israelites got to Elim. But now here we are in chapter 16, and this chapter is going to expand on those lessons as these people continue to face seemingly insurmountable problems and making their way through the desert. We're going to look at that this morning under the title, Principles of Divine Provision. Principles of Divine Provision. The issue here is that these people have a great need, and God steps in to provide that need. And in the way that he approaches it, and in the way that the story is told, we're learning a number of these lessons about the Lord's provision that have their parallel in our lives as well. So what is the first principle? Verses 1 to 3, here it is, material need reveals spiritual weakness. You have a material need, but it actually ends up being used of the Lord to bring to light a much deeper spiritual problem. Material need reveals spiritual weakness. Let's read these first three verses. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. When you go out of chapter 15 into that verse, and those first three verses, there's really not much of a transition into this new episode. It is like the jolt back to work after vacation. And soon after they set out, having experienced God's refreshment at that oasis, they are doing what they had done back in chapter 15, verse 24, and they are grumbling. And in this case, it wasn't just a few of the people. Verse 2 says it was the whole congregation of the people of Israel. This is mass complaining. The first time they grumbled back in 15, the issue was a lack of water. Now they say they lack food. They want bread. They want meat. We would say they weren't hungry. They were hangry at this point. Now, you and I have faced that situation. I'm kind of hungry right now myself. And there are legitimate physical needs, and it does boggle the mind as to how they might have confronted this large problem with so many thousands upon thousands of people. How are they going to eat? But the text actually points us into a different direction about their response and about the attitude that they demonstrated to the Lord as they are wrestling with this material need. And one of the things that becomes apparent is that they are looking at this problem from a purely human standpoint. Did you notice that when they grumble, it says in verse 2, their grumbling was against Moses and Aaron. And then when they're getting pretty strong in their language, verse 3 says, talking to those men, you have brought us into this wilderness. Where is the Lord in any of that? Nothing is said about Yahweh. Either they are afraid to trace their circumstances back to the original source, or they haven't actually learned very much at all from everything that they've been through. They're looking at things from the standpoint of people. Moses and Aaron, you got us into this mess. Moses and Aaron were upset with you because we're so hungry. And another problem is that they have a warped perspective of the past, which verse 3 says, as they're thinking back on Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. Well, I don't know, but maybe they did have enough to eat in Egypt. And maybe there were resources for them. But that was not the full picture at all of what was taking place in Egypt. They were humiliated and they were abused slaves. And even if they did have enough food, their experience was one of just begging God to deliver them from this oppressive situation. And so they have this warped view of the past. And then they go on and they assign hostile motives to Moses and Aaron. That's the third indication of their spiritual problem. They say in verse 3, you have brought us into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. After all that Moses had done for them, this is the accusation. That doesn't even make any sense logically in light of everything that Moses himself had risked in order to guide them and to serve as their leader under God. But their hunger prompted them to turn against the man that had cared for them and had been their kind of shepherd and through whom the Lord had worked so many mighty things. This is part of their spiritual problem at this point. They're looking at things from a purely human standpoint. They have a warped perspective of the past, and they are assigning hostile motives to their leaders. Now, we can be very critical of them, but we understand that when we're hangry or when there's some other situation going on that is putting pressure on us, a lot of stuff comes out of our mouths and a lot of stuff comes out of our hearts that reflects wrong thinking or that is at best misguided, right? This is why, for example, marriage counselors will tell couples to ban from their vocabulary the words always and never. Because if you're in an argument with your spouse, the temptation is to blow things out of proportion. And maybe they did fail you. Maybe they even have a habit of failing you. But the moment you say, you always do this, or you never do this, that rhetoric is ratcheting up the emotion, and it's probably not accurate. I wanted to say it's never accurate, but I'm not supposed to use always and never. More than likely, your stress is causing you to use this exaggerated, dramatic language that is not helping the situation, that's actually just throwing fuel on this fire and digging yourself into a bigger hole. That's what's happening here. And here's a warning for us, that the next time we are faced with an overwhelming need and we find ourselves thinking certain thoughts and saying certain words, take stock of your attitude. Are you looking at things as though God is not a factor? Are you glamorizing the past? Are you harshly judging the people that God has brought into your life to help you? Those are the kinds of spiritual weaknesses that our physical needs tend to just put out on the table. So the question is now, how is the Lord going to respond to these kinds of accusations and attitudes? And the more that this kind of thing happens, eventually there's going to be some pretty heavy punishments that he's going to bring upon them. And yet the Lord is so gracious, it's like he knows these people are still in kindergarten. And he doesn't pull out, if I could put it this way, the big hammer just yet. He is very tender with them. He is exceedingly gracious. He actually responds to their grumbling by giving them what they are asking for. So we're going to see a lot about the Lord's mercy in terms of physical provision, and yet there's more to it than that. That physical blessing has a deeper purpose. Just like the material need revealed a spiritual weakness, what we're going to see next is that divine provision targets spiritual growth. It wasn't just a matter of, okay, you're hungry, here's some food to eat. There was that, but that wasn't all of it. That wasn't even the main point that the Lord was making. Divine provision targets spiritual growth. And this is the longest part of the chapter. It is the heart of the passage. The Lord does meet Israel's needs in a miraculous way through the provision of manna, but he uses that provision to grow them in their walk with him. And you find different kinds of responses that he is dealing with as we work our way through this passage. In verses 4 to 5, the spiritual growth is just a matter of using this situation so that they might grow in their obedience. So there's an emphasis here on obeying the Lord. Look at verses 4 and 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day." Notice that, a day's portion every day. Why? "That I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." There is an emphasis on the day-by-day nature of the provision. And it wasn't like most of us do, where we go to Walmart and we stock up for a week or more. Now, these people had to go out, as it were, to shop or to get the food. But the provision was enough for just one day, with the exception of the sixth day, when there was a double portion. And so there was a sufficient provision, but the way that God went about meeting that need, there were also rules as to how to get that provision and how this was all going to work. Why did the Lord do that? Why didn't he just say, "Here's a bunch of food"? He says, "I'm doing it this way that I may test them whether they will walk in my way or not." I'm putting out there a certain amount of what we could say were arbitrary rules. Like, why did it have to be this way by nature? He could have done it anyway, but he chose this method for the purpose of testing them on the issue of obedience. Now, of course, he knew that probably many of them would struggle to obey. But he wanted them to see their weakness. And that was important, this issue of obedience, and that he had a law, because just a few chapters later, he's going to give them a whole bunch more rules. And we call that the law of the Mosaic Covenant. They needed now, early on, to begin understanding just how in charge God was. Just how much they needed to submit to him. And just how dependent they were on God for the mercy of enabling obedience. And so he lays this out in a very, very specific day-by-day doling out of this food that required them to think, now, what day is it and what did God say and how do we go about this? You know, in the New Testament, Jesus drives home a similar idea. And it has to do with food when he's teaching us to pray. And what does he say? He says, pray this way, "Give me this week my trip to Walmart." fill up my pantry and my refrigerator for the next 2 weeks. Or I've also got a freezer in the garage. And fill that up too with a bunch of meat that's going to get me all the way through the winter. That's not what he says. He says, pray this way, give us this day our daily bread. Now, God in his mercy will often give us more than that, and he will provide for us way ahead of time, more than we need for just one day. But there's at least a spirit that he is inculcating there of a moment-by-moment daily dependence on him for everything. And if it's not with the bread, which most of us in this country don't have a struggle about, there probably are other sorts of things that he uses, whether physical needs or personal struggles or family burdens. There are probably other things, other needs that he uses to reinforce this idea that we are the creatures, not the creator, and that we are under authority and we are beholden to God for everything. This is one of these ongoing principles of how he works with us. You can expect that God in heaven is going to ordain your circumstances such that whether it's by food or something else, you are constrained to cultivate a moment by moment, day by day reliance upon him. But it wasn't just about submitting to him and just following his rules. It was also about something else that we get into going further in this passage. It was about knowing the Lord. Not just obeying the Lord, but knowing the Lord. So look at verse 6. It says, so Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us? And Moses says, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, save the whole congregation of the people of Israel. Come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am Yahweh, your God. Any of that sound familiar? Four times in what I just read, the text points out that the grumbling had not been against Aaron and Moses. It does bring God back in the picture, and it says the Lord heard your grumbling and it was against him. And verse 6 says that through the experience that is to come, they're going to see as well that it was Yahweh, not Moses, who brought them out of Egypt. As if, like, why did you even doubt that to begin with? There's also an emphasis on these people a couple of times in this scenario, beholding a special manifestation of the glory of the Lord. Did you catch that? And then the climactic statement in verse 12, what we have come to expect as the goal throughout this narrative in Exodus, then you shall know that I am Yahweh your God. Through this material provision, God was working not just to feed them, but to bring them to a greater experience of who he was as their covenant-keeping God. This was all about beholding the glory of God, recognizing that my sin is against him, coming to know him in a deeper way. And if these people did come to know him, it would generate another kind of response or attitude toward the Lord, which is the matter of trusting him. Trusting the Lord in verses 13 to 18. Let's read those verses. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. Now the point in that little section is that things happened exactly the way God had said they would happen. The miraculous provision, the amount, how it corresponded to what each individual person needed. On top of that, for this one occasion anyway, the Lord blessed them with something special, and that night they had a quail barbecue. But the miracle that kept getting repeated every day was that bread literally dropped out of the sky for them. And yet it was only enough for what each person needed for one day. And so, even though on the front end in the earlier passage, you know, you kind of wonder, these people are hearing this for the first time. Like, we know the story so well, and talking about manna is just kind of normal Christian jargon. But they had never experienced anything like this. Like, we're actually going to go out and there's going to be something to eat just on the ground, and every day it's going to be there again? That sounded so impossible to the point of being ridiculous to the natural mind. But the Lord, in those verses we read, he pulled it off without a hitch. And that fulfillment of what was basically a prophecy was intended to deepen their trust in the Lord. That if he said something was going to happen, for as just out of our experience and seemingly impossible as it might appear, it was going to come to pass without fear, without fail. And I appreciate what commentator Douglas Stewart has to say about how the Lord was working and what he was doing through all those kinds of experiences. He says this: "All of these challenges were part of a plan to develop a people's willingness to trust him. Explaining everything in advance would have run counter to that plan. It was necessary for Israel to learn faith while confused, while afraid, while desperate, not just in theory, but under pressure of actual conditions where survival was uncertain and faith was tested to the limit. Could God have supplied the manna before they even grumbled? Before their food brought from Egypt had run out? Of course. But how would that have taught them the special sort of patience that he knew they would need to exercise in the future as his people when things got really hard?" In other words, this was all part of this building experience and throwing another curveball at them, but working in unexpected ways that could not be humanly explained in order not just to provide for them, but to deepen their knowledge of God, their trust in him, because they were going to really need it going forward. And do you suppose that the Lord ever works that way in your life? Leading you into some need that you have no way of meeting, or into some problem that you have no way of solving. And it feels like the Lord is torturing you, or at best that he is ignoring you. And yet the purpose is not just to solve the problem, but it is to grow your faith, to meet a spiritual need that is greater than your physical need, trusting in the Lord. Now, initially, it seems that people of Israel got that lesson, at least for this one situation. But in the rest of this part of the story, actually, the story starts to go in a negative direction where at least some of the people are making big mistakes. And it shows they didn't quite get it. So as we read the rest of this, 19 to 30, you know, he just said, you got to obey me. I want you to know me. I want you to trust me through this. But now you have records of some of them failing and actually disobeying the Lord. And it occurs in two ways. The first disobedience that is recorded has to do with the issue of the weekday portion and the day-by-day provision. Look at verses 19 to 21. Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over till the morning." It's like Paul said, if God hadn't said don't covet, I might not have struggled so much, right? The Lord says, I'm going to provide for you every day. Don't leave it to the morning. Just throw it out. Somebody says, I wonder what would happen if we just kind of kept this in a corner. Let's not tell anybody. Just a little experiment. I'm not being that rebellious. I just want to kind of check things out, right? They did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning, so they apparently got that part, and so morning by morning they got into the habit, they gathered it, each as much as he could eat, but when the sun grew hot, it melted. And so they're learning the hard way the need for obedience. Now, they didn't all of them learn it too well, because there's this second incident that doesn't have to do with the daily portion or throwing it away or whatever, but it has to do with the issue of the Sabbath now. And so let's read starting at verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow, okay, so they're wondering, why is there more here? He says, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning. So most days they weren't supposed to do that. This day they would, they should. They laid aside till the morning as Moses commanded them. It did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. Verse 27. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, so in the one passage, Moses was angry. Now the Lord speaks up. He says, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people, they got the point. They rested on the seventh day. And so you read about these people. Again, apparently it was a small group, but that didn't collect on the sixth day. And the Lord got angry. As a parent, I might have just looked befuddled at them and like, where were you? Like, didn't I already talk about this? These people, it goes over their head, or they didn't think the Lord was serious, or they could get away with something. And they go out there, I don't know, maybe somebody took pity on them and gave them some food. Maybe they went hungry for a day because of their neglect. Now, there's a lot in that passage about the Sabbath itself. I'm not going to get into that this morning. We are going to talk about that in some depth when we get to chapter 20, where the Sabbath is a part of the Decalogue. For now, we just want to note that the Lord is working here to put in place the Sabbath. Actually, we discover the Sabbath was talked about before the Ten Commandments. And it's part of another thing. It's like another layer of what God is doing at this point. That, yes, it was about providing their needs and obedience and trust and everything, but he's also putting in place something that he knows is going to be important in the future. This thing about the Sabbath. The Lord can be doing more than one thing at a time when he takes us through an experience of need. In this case, in addition to everything else we've seen, he's also preparing them for other lessons that he's going to explain later down the road. And here's a helpful observation for us as well. When we're going through these kinds of desert experiences, we really do tend to have tunnel vision. And we're just zeroed in, focused in on the need of the moment, what is right in front of us. And what we discover in a passage like this is that God's plan is way bigger than that. It is way more complicated than that. We are encouraged to default to an attitude of distrusting our ideas, of over-prioritizing the immediate, of giving God the benefit of the doubt that he is doing many different things for our good through an individual immediate circumstance. And so the Lord has taught them and us that, first of all, material need reveals spiritual weakness. Secondly, that divine provision targets spiritual growth. And then the passage ends on a very positive note in verses 31 to 36. And here's how I would put it. Divine provision deserves ongoing commemoration. Let me say that again. After all the Lord did to provide and to teach them through these things, it's like he's saying, look, please remember this. And I'm going to put certain things in place to kind of constrain you to remember, to keep commemorating this. Divine provision deserves ongoing commemoration. Verse 31. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. So now he's laying down another expectation. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations so that they may see the bread which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is the tenth part of an ephah. Now, this bread is called manna, which reflects the Hebrew word for what. Going back to verse 15, where they said, what is it? And because they didn't really have an answer, the only name that stuck was the word what. It's no surprise, then, that when we come along and we read these things, you know, white, like coriander seed, taste of it like wafers made with honey, we want to know what it is. And as you would expect with these kinds of miracles, there are all kinds of bizarre naturalistic explanations that go totally against the teaching of the text, that don't really make any sense for all the different characteristics of what was happening here. But those of us who take the text at face value, if we're wondering, well, what was this? Or how did it work? Or exactly what was its, you know, composition? And my answer to that is, what? I don't know. And I don't need to know, because if I knew too much, it would probably kind of diminish the miraculousness of it. The whole point is, this was just incredible. It defies explanation. That's like the whole point. And because it was such a significant act of God, the Lord wanted it to be memorialized. That is the emphasis in what we read there. Notice that in verse 32 and 33, he says, I want you to remember this throughout your generations. And in fact, store some of this up. And here's going to be another miracle, that this little bit that we collect up here is not going to go bad, and it's not going to stink, and there aren't going to be worms. And I want you to store it up in a special place as an ongoing testimony indefinitely in the future for the people of God to be reminded of what I did. In fact, verse 34 seems to be talking about it from the perspective of later, after the tabernacle was built, and this memorial manna was actually placed in the Ark of the Covenant as a witness to those later generations. When you read what the rest of Scripture says about what was put in the Ark, there were only three things. The manna, the staff of Aaron, and the tablet with the Ten Commandments. You think about all the different things that might have been interesting or that were big deals in the history of God's people. Three only were chosen, and the manna was one of them. This was, from God's standpoint, one of the major tools that he was using to teach his people about himself, to grow them in their trust, and to prepare them for the future. He wanted them to keep alive, visibly, the memory of his mighty and his faithful provision. He wanted them to worship him for what he had done. And we look at that and say, well, that's amazing, but what does that have to do with us? And I would draw out this general principle. Remember, the point was, divine provision deserves ongoing commemoration. I would draw out this principle that you and I ought to keep alive the memory of what the Lord has done to meet our material needs. That's a starting point. Since we're talking about material needs, how the Lord supplied, what we learned about him through it, it is a good thing to celebrate his mighty and faithful provision for us, just like they were supposed to. Which leads me to point out that in a couple of weeks, we are at Thanksgiving, when we traditionally gather together to do that very thing. And here we have a kind of a model of the way the Lord views that and encourages that. And I'd like to encourage us to plan to be here on the evening of November 22nd. It's the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. It's our annual praise service. And to encourage us to be preparing something to say for the glory of God, for the encouragement of God's people, to do this very thing, to commemorate his provision. And yet, I don't want to limit this to the material, just like this passage doesn't. And folks, this has everything to do with our celebration of the Lord's table. I got into this passage, I almost did not preach on this passage. Because initially I'm like, what does that have to do with the Lord's Supper? Listen to what Jesus does with this text in John chapter 6. Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written. He gave them bread from heaven to eat. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. They said to him, sir, give us this bread always. Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. I'm sure Jesus would affirm all these lessons I've drawn out of here, but he is adding one other, or just giving us the sort of end of the story. He says, you know what? All this about God's going to provide, and God's going to do miracles in order to meet your need. Actually, let that point you ahead to myself, my person, my work. I came down from heaven as the ultimate bread of life. And if you will partake of me like those people partook of the bread and it kept them alive, you are going to live forever. And a little later, he adds this, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life. And I will raise him up on the last day. Now, I don't think that in that passage the Lord was talking directly about the Lord's Supper. But he was using this concept of eating his flesh and drinking his blood as a metaphor for saving faith. For a total reliance on his atoning work, so much so that it's like you're actually taking it into you as that which will sustain your life. I don't think he was talking directly about the Lord's Supper, but the image there certainly does lay a foundation for what is now symbolized in the Lord's Supper. A commemorative meal that requires us physically to take bread and drink into our body, not because those elements do anything, but because we are confessing, I am relying entirely, my entire existence, sin, destiny, life on earth, everything is relying exclusively on these things. That's what I'm showing when I eat them and drink them. Just like the Israelites depended on God's daily provision of manna, moment by moment, we depend on the glorious provision that these elements represent. The blood and the body of Jesus that feed us and save us eternally. And may we celebrate in true commemoration of this divine provision through the elements of the Lord's Supper today. I'd like to ask our men to come and prepare the table for us.